Hello and welcome to I Am The Egg Pod, hosted by me, Chris Shaw. The Egg Pods take a jaunty stroll through Pepperland, discussing the Beatles and solo Beatle albums with a potpourri of delicious guests. In this episode, I'm joined by broadcaster, author and tip-top Britpop drummer, Matt Everitt.
That'll do. I don't mind that. Yeah, that works.
Thank you. Hello, Matt.
Hello, mate.
Today we are talking about the Beatles' December 1965 album, Rubber Soul. So, firstly, I think, obviously, ask why you picked this, but going back, when did the Beatles first come into your world?
The Beatles have been in my life for as long as I can remember. It's just been omnipresent, like lots of people, and has been talked about before. The Red and Blue was my kind of window into it, going on those long drives to family holidays in the 70s and 80s, where my parents would insist on piling me and my brother into the Ford Cortina and driving to, you know, some part of Europe. It just driving for days and days and days and days in a stuffy Ford Cortina, and everyone would be allowed one cassette each. That's how we'd entertain the family. Right. And my mum would always choose either cassette one or cassette two of the Red and the Blue for as long as I can remember. So that's the start. But Rubber Soul is also where it starts. You can't see this. This is my mum's copy of Rubber Soul. So my mum's in her early 70s, and this is the copy that she bought when she was 16, 17.
Did she write her name on it?
That's the bit of sellotape where her name used to be, which I love, that idea that you used to go to a party with your name on your record or your single to make sure you got it back at the end of the evening. And so it's obviously an old copy. It's slightly yellowed. It's beautiful. So this is what the Beatles means to me. This is the first thing that I remember seeing in the record, because cassettes look a bit shit. What's the swearing? How much can we swear on this?
Do what you want.
Cassettes look fucking shit. whereas records are a lovely thing. And when you're a kid, you know, looking in your parents' record collection, these are hallowed objects. Especially my folks didn't have too many records. But this was my mum's. And aside from my family and a couple of items, this is one of the most prized possessions that I own. And it's just it's a thing of beauty. So this is where it starts for me, really.
Yeah. Has it got the advert for Emitex? The wipe? Yes.
It's got that on the back. As I've been sort of, and we'll talk about this a lot, as I've been delving into this, I've been sort of looking at the history of the record even deeper than I have before. Mm. And it's the first record sleeve that the band's name isn't on the cover.
Yes.
It's just Rubber Soul.
Yeah.
Which says quite a lot, I think, about how they thought about themselves. It's like, we don't need to say who we are anymore because look at us.
Yeah.
It's that gorgeous sort of shade of brown that seemed that most of my childhood seemed to be that kind of corduroy beige Draylon brown. So it feels like my childhood, even though it was obviously a bit before. So this is where it started. And in a wider sense, you know, the reason I became a musician, the reason I now talk to musicians for a job, is all, it starts here. This is responsible for my whole career and my life. This is why it's this record.
Wow. that's a big onus.
It's a pretty big opener.
Yeah. Because I was thinking Britpop, obviously, around the time, I remember the Beatles were cited by everybody, Oasis and Blur and blah, blah, blah. I could never quite pick that up in sort of menswear. I never really heard
that's
much.
That's because the Beatles were good.
Oh.
Menswear weren't.
I liked men's.
I mean, not that anybody would know, but I nicked a couple of Ringo Phils for menswear stuff.
Did
just because I love his play. There's going to be a lot of Ringo chat here. as a drummer.
There's I was going to say, yes.
There's a lot. It's a good... This is where Ringo really starts to be Ringo, this record, isn't it? So that is... I'd always... Yeah, it's very difficult. It's easy to reference, isn't it? Oh, yeah, we love the Beatles, but you don't sound like them. Why? Yeah. Because they're better than you are.
I would never say that.
You can.
But, well, so 1965, obviously, when this album came out, it was an insane year for them. You go through the Mark Lewisohn books and look at the diary and what they were doing, it was just relentless. So aside from the relentless tours they were doing, Ringo married Maureen at the beginning of the year.
Oh.
They filmed Help, made the album Help, got the MBE, like you do.
As you do.
Toured Europe and the US, including the Shea Stadium gig.
Yep. Named after the famous guerrilla leader.
Yeah. Oh, yes.
Shea Stadium.
Yeah. We'll get on to the Rattles later. And, so they did all that. And I think it was literally August the 31st, they finished the US tour. And they had, for the first time, really, since Beatlemania, they had a 6-week break.
Slackers.
Thinking.
I know.
And, yeah, they had time. And I'm not sure how it works, because they had, every year they did two albums, and they always had the one that came out for Christmas, the December album. So I think there must, for them to have that amount of time and not start recording till October, they must have been pushing Brian Epstein, saying, please, please, can we just have a break?
It's staggering. It is staggering, the workload that they undertook. There's that lovely quote from, I think it's Rick Rubin, that says,
oh, yeah,
the sheer fact that they achieved what they did in that space of time proves the existence of God.
Yeah.
Which is, it's quite a quote, but there is.
It is.
There is something. What I've found about this process, because I've really gone back into it again, has been this idea of, like, looking at the nuts and bolts in a way that I've maybe never looked before. But the more I sort of disseminate it and sort of break it into individual parts, what they achieved on this record, the more it does seem superhuman. It's kind of humanized and deified them at the same time, if that makes sense.
Yes.
Because it's astonishing what they did. Yeah. And you can look at how they did it and why they did it and what gave them the capability and the history. But the fact they did it at all is touched by the divine a little bit, I think.
To that level
to
as
that
well.
Level, yeah.
It was, on paper, it's a rushed album.
Yeah.
But it's not. It's clearly not. So I think we also have to mention, obviously, before we got on the album, Day Tripper, We Can Work Out, which we're recording during the sessions, strangely released as a single on the same day as the album. So they were two completely different entities, number one album, number one single, but they had nothing in common with each other at all, other than the name The Beatles.
That's cocky, that, isn't it?
It is.
That's really, that is. I think there is something of that in the performances from this era, from the songs in this era, even from the artwork. I was holding the record there. That is not a band who are unsure of who they are.
Yeah,
that is a very confident band.
Especially John.
Especially John. That's imperious, right down the nose.
It is.
Look at that. That hair is fucking great. That is some very good hair, isn't it? I mean, that hair... Like, there's generation after generation of rock star have been pursuing that hair. That's hair goals, isn't it? It really is. They look so... They know it.
They do.
They absolutely know it.
Yeah.
Which is interesting when we come to some of the lyrical content. But yeah, they are a band supremely in control. Maybe that's the fact they had a break.
It could be. I don't know. So again, on paper, it's the studio years, isn't it, I guess?
Yeah.
This is,
you may argue, and please do, is the first record. I know it wasn't the first studio record because they toured it after then. This probably shouldn't have been toured. I don't think these songs work live as they do in the studio. It's a studio record. It's their first genuine studio record.
Yeah. Well, the only ones they performed live were Nowhere Man. That's it. If I Needed Someone.
Well, yeah. I mean, Nowhere Man. That's a hell of a vocal performance live.
Yeah.
But even then, it wasn't up to what it was in the studio. Anywhere near, was it?
No. Well, that was the 66 tour, which was just a complete nightmare from the beginning, really, wasn't it?
So. Yeah, this is the start of albums existing just to exist on the record and not existing anywhere else. Ask the girl what she wanted to be.
Yes, I'm gonna be a star. Baby, you can drive my car. And maybe I love you.
Should we start with track one, Drive My Car?
Yeah.
And immediately, something different is something new is happening here. It's lyrically, musically, from Help, yeah. Say, and the fans must be thinking, what's this all about?
Well, I mean, it's bass and drums, isn't it? Actually, it's bass and drums, and it's tambourine.
Yes,
that's what it is. First, you've got this. Is this the first time Macro had used the Rickenbacker? Was this? Are we around that era?
Around that era. I'm not sure.
Bass has never been louder. Up to this point before. It's an awesome bit of bass playing. And Ringo's drumming is off the chart. I mean, I know that you can talk about it being a bit of a joke song because it's got a punchline. But it's very wry. And it's just underplayed by this staggering rhythm section performance that really does knock your socks off. It's a great opener. I don't even talk about why the Americans didn't put it on the US version of the album. That is an absolute travesty, which I shall rant about later, given an hour.
And some of the other songs that weren't on it as well.
Good God.
Anyway.
But it's, aside from the fact the drums sound brilliant and Ringo is on peak, how the hell did he do that drum fill for? Yeah. There's stuff that, I mean, I'm not, you know, a particularly talented drummer, but there's stuff there that I just don't know where and when he finishes those beats and how he comes in.
Is it because he's left-handed? Does that...
He leads with his left. Yeah, so he's left-handed on a right-handed drum kit, which means rather than going snare, tom, around like that, you lead with your left hand. So you're playing differently anyway.
Right.
But even then, it's completely... It's hat stand, how he does it.
Yeah.
And it's got that thing where it sounds like they're trying to infuse it with a certain pace, but it's a bit slower than maybe it should be for probably the reasons that they were getting quite high at the time.
They were, yes.
So, yeah.
Some higher than others, I think.
Okay, who was...
I think Paul was the one that relented most about LSD.
Always Paul.
Well, he didn't have the need. He was surrounded by family. He was in the middle class thing of going to all the shows and Joan Asher shows. And again, as we'll discover during the album, things weren't that great at home. But I've been thinking, because we've talked about Paul and John a lot. A lot of people say John was more edgy. But I think he was just happy and content with himself, that he didn't feel the need to actually bare his soul to the public. And I think, with LSD, I can understand why he was concerned about that.
Yeah. I mean, I should say, as a very important caveat, they're all amazing, every single one of them. I don't have, it's quite easy to sort of, pick at the failings of each of them, but I think they're all absolutely excellent people. And as I will wang on about when we talk about meeting them, because I can't...
We will.
I can't not do that.
I know you can't.
How incredible my limited experience is of meeting them. So I'm not dissing Paul when I say, typical.
No.
You know, but it feels... It's got this real slowed down... It's like the whole thing's been dropped a couple of BPM, which gives it this real, almost hypnotic groove to it. Mm. And the tambourine playing is amazing. This is my other theory about this record. I've got a couple. This is the great Beatles percussion record.
Yeah.
I think there's some maraca, action here that makes the record. But the tambourine playing, people don't talk about tambourine playing enough. It can absolutely make a song.
Yeah.
And there's a bit in the last third of the song where the tambourine play, this is boring, isn't it? Not for me. Where it goes to the offbeat, just out of the blue.
Okay.
And it's incredible. It just totally changes the song without changing anything apart from the tambourine. You're not even aware that it's happening.
Yeah.
It just changes the emphasis.
You've got the cowbell as well.
More cowbell sound. Is it one of your favourite openers? Because some people are a little bit reticent because it's...
I think it's one of the best songs they ever made. I absolutely love this song so much. I think, having listened to Otis Redding's version of Respect, you can hear... When you were saying about the bass is a lot heavier, I think that was because George and Paul were dueling at the same time. Boom, boom,
Oh, that's so good.
Have a listen to Otis Redding's Respect, and you'll hear some influences there big time, which they've openly cited.
Which is fine. Everyone gets it from somewhere.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah, it's I love it. It's the first thing. It's got that when you put the needle back down, when you put the needle on the record for the first time. Mm. That's how it comes in, and the feels are great.
I love the fact you mentioned something to me when you interviewed Paul. First of all, we must. There is an incredible list of people that Matt has interviewed over the few years, but the ones, just Google Matt Everett, go on image search and just read it and weep.
It's a bit nuts.
I love your story. You said after you'd interviewed Paul, what you did afterwards.
Yeah, it takes, I mean, it's the one, isn't it, an interview with Paul McCartney. It's something that you sort of wait your entire career to do. And I've been interviewing musicians for a very long time, 7-8 years before I even got close. And then, you know, I got, I think the first call was about the Grammys about 6 years ago. And we got a phone call saying, you want to speak to him? I was like, yeah, of course. And it was a phone call, because I think he'd just done the Grammys with Dave Grohl. And he'd apparently said, as apparently he does, that was really good. I want to talk to someone about that. And so his people, who are lovely, are like, okay, let's see who might be the right person to speak to. And they chose me, very fortunately. And then you find yourself sitting in the studio, waiting for the phone to ring.
Ooh.
And normally what happens with these, with a lot of really, really big famous interviews, you get, you wait for the allotted time and nothing happens. And about 15 minutes later, management come on the line and go, hi, Mr. So-and-so, or Mrs. So-and-so will be calling to you in a bit. And then you wait a bit longer. And then eventually the phone rings back and someone else says, oh, hi, they will be with you in 15 minutes. And eventually the phone gets passed on to the star in question. It's not like that with Macca. The phone rings, you pick it up, and there's Paul McCartney on the other end of the phone. There's no matter, you fucking lose your shit. It's amazing. Yeah. And then your brain has a kind of like weird sort of jump where it starts to, it's very strange because your brain is going, oh, I'm listening to Paul McCartney. And at the other point, your brain goes, you're talking to Paul McCartney.
You need to communicate.
And the first thing he said, he was like, where are you? Where are you in the world? I want to get a fix on you. So I was like, oh, I'm in, because it was just around the corner from where we're doing this, Oxford Circus.
Yeah.
And then he asks you questions. This is quite an interesting little thing. I think because he's a man who's been interviewed a fair bit. And he didn't know, I don't think we weren't familiar or anything like that. He asks you questions, and I think that eats away some of the interview time. It's less time he has to talk to you about. Now, I don't mean this in a rude or disparaging way, but he'll ask you questions and you answer.
Oh yeah, what have you been up to?
And no one's interested in what I've been up to, but it eats away a few minutes of your allotted 8 minutes you've got.
Yeah.
Because maybe then he doesn't have to talk quite as much. Mm. But anyway, he was courteous and brilliant and fantastic. And we did a couple of other phone interviews. And then it was... he wanted to talk about the reissue of Flowers in the Dirt. Mm. And I was like, I like that record. It's got some good stuff on it, that record. Mm. And so we got invited to MPL, his offices in Golden Square in London. And up we go. We get ushered into his beautiful building. It's so nice.
Yeah.
And unlike lots of other massive stars, he doesn't have a huge entourage. I interviewed one of Metallica once. They had 14 people with them.
Really?
Fucking mental.
Really?
And Macca's got like his lovely sort of promo dude and his assistant in the office, and that was it. And you sit there, and then he comes in.
Wow.
Holding a Sports Direct mug.
Really?
One of my big takeaways.
Ooh. Exclusive on the Egg Pod. Start subscribing.
And it was brilliant. He was as funny and charming and cool. This is the thing I tell people. You're so familiar with the idea of what Paul McCartney is, you forget how cool he is. Yeah. Like, that cool. Like, he's someone you want to... I've been fortunate enough to interview Keith Richards, and Keith Richards is exactly as you'd expect. He's the kind of cool guy you want to hang out with. But Paul's got that and kind of more.
Mm.
He's got this very, very easygoing, laid-back kind of persona.
Mm.
You know, it's all happy and smiles, but he's quite intense at the same time.
Oh, really?
He's quite.
Is he intense, or are you perceiving that? Perhaps.
I think he engages. He definitely engages in questions. I've interviewed lots of people when they kind of go through the hoops.
Mm.
It was different meeting him face to face, and we're talking about. We ended the interview, and he just took a guitar down off the wall and just started strumming away, to which my brain is leaping out of my ears.
Yeah.
I said, oh, you know, have you still got the habit? Do you still buy a lot of them? He went, oh, yeah, there's little, this is off Oxford Circus, Oxford Street. Yeah, there's a little sort of acoustic guitar shop around the corner. He goes, oh, yeah, I know that one. He says, yeah, I just pop in there, you know, get out the car, pop in.
Oh, wow.
Get a couple of things from the guitars. Then I just walk back to the office. I'm like, you walk across.
Really?
Yeah, because you can just be in cars too long. So this idea.
He shouldn't be doing that.
I've heard this from a couple of people, people that used to work with him. He loves just like, oh, let's just walk this bit. No, you've got to be in the car from this place to this place.
Yeah.
No, let's just go for a walk. I think he likes.
Yeah.
Mixing it up a little bit.
Yeah.
And I think that's, you know, wow. That's brilliant.
That is good.
And then we finished the interview and I went across the road for a very large gin and tonic in a Soho bar and burst into tears.
Oh, that's so...
It was like in complete silence. And then, yeah, it was... Oh. It's lovely because he's... And you can cut a load of this out if you want.
No.
He's very aware when he's giving you a John story
or
a Beatles story. But it always, he knows how special it is for you.
Yes.
And carries that really lightly.
Yeah.
Which is a really gentlemanly and great thing to do. Ringo's different. But he knows if he's talking to you about a John thing. We asked about, because I wanted to ask him about how he'd want to be remembered if he died. You know, and I said, oh, look, when I go, I want black horses with plumes. I want to be driven down the centre of my old house street in Birmingham and cavalcade all the way to London. And I want weeping friends. What do you want? Just kind of make a bit of a joke out of it. And he just talked. I said, I don't really think about it. But John always used to really worry about that. And I was like, and your heart skips a beat.
Whoa.
And I'd say, it's fine, John. Don't worry about it. You know, you're a good guy. They'll remember you doing good stuff.
Yeah.
And you get these little moments and you think, I haven't read that. I haven't heard that before.
Yeah.
I'm hearing him talking about something, you know, that maybe he hasn't said to anyone. Maybe, probably has. I've interviewed him a couple of times. We'll talk about, I went to his studio in Sussex, but we'll talk about that later. But it was a similar thing. Mm. But yeah, it's brilliant. It's everything you want. It's me talking to the guy on that cover I've been looking at since I was 3 years old.
Yeah.
And not being disappointed.
And as cool as he was
there. And cooler, I think. Yeah.
Superb. Oh, I love that. Thank you. I got no car and it's breaking my heart. But I found a driver and that's a start.
Maybe you can drive my car. If it's a joke song, it's a good joke.
It is.
I don't think it matters.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think that it's got a punchline. But I don't think that's a bad thing because it's a really good gag.
Yeah.
And also it's the first of these amazing confident women that crop up all through the album. She's the first one. She's the first one.
Yeah.
She's in charge.
A lot of the women in the songs are, aren't they?
Which I find really interesting. So yeah, more of which will emerge, I'm sure, as we keep talking. She wanted me. She's shown me her room. Isn't it good? Norwegian wood.
This bird has flown.
Yeah.
You can hear the marijuana. You can smell it. You can taste it.
You think? What I love about Norwegian Wood is connected to my mum owning the record. Because she used to say, when they used to take this round, they used to play it. You know, her and her friends would listen to it.
Lovely.
And she said it was impossibly racy. Like, and then she said, let's go to bed. And that was like seen as being an absolute, wow, they went to go and do it.
Yeah.
They did it. The people in the story are going off to do it.
Yeah.
And how shocked and excited and the kind of, you know, this was sort of unspoken thing to lots of sort of teenagers who'd maybe... You know, who bought Beatles records before or were fans. And I just love that idea of these sort of 16-year-old, 17-year-old kids running around, you know, sitting around listening to this record going, oh, my God, that's explicit. It's dangerous.
Yeah.
So that's my...
Except they didn't do it. That's the thing.
As I found out later, you know, this is the thing. This is another amazing sort of mysterious, confident woman who says, who gets John back to her place. And I go, nah. Thanks for the chat, John. Yeah. But I'm not fussed.
Yeah.
I mean, what is that? Is that John's? Is he? Is this wishful thinking? Is this John waiting, or looking for someone in his life that's gonna? That is. I'm theorising a bit here. That's going to provide him with the kind of challenge, intellectually or philosophically, that he hasn't got at the moment.
Yeah.
I don't know, is that right, do you think?
I think, I mean, we can. Girl is a good example
another
of
one,
that
yeah,
as well.
Yeah.
His ideal woman seems to be, even back to 64, 65, it's Yoko. Mm. You read the lyrics and that's Yoko. And also, I think, very similar to, I mean, that's another story, but Julia, his mother, and in some respects Aunt Mimi, but all very strong authoritarian women, that where the guy is, yes, dear. That was his dream. That was his dream woman. I guess his strong mother. But
I think it's also when you're that cool, you know, they would have had anything they wanted.
Yeah.
More or less, you know, I would imagine. Be that, you know, artistic influences or drugs or girls. You know, and when everything's on a plate, you want, well, what else is there?
Yeah.
And what I want is, I want something that's gonna spark me, something that's gonna feel new and different. Mm. And maybe that's some of it. You know, I don't know. I like her, whoever she is. I really like her.
Well, she could be.
Go on.
So they say, Maureen Cleave, who was the Evening Standard, writer, who he did the Beatles Bigger Than Christ interview with. Could be Eleanor Bron, the actress.
Oh, all cool people. Yeah.
All cool people, yeah. Could be Pete Shotton's wife.
Oh, John.
Could be Al McCogan. These are the names that have flown around over the years. But you think all very similar, well, you don't want to generalise it, all very strong women. Very
culturally smart, savvy, yes, interesting women in their own right who don't necessarily need to fuck a beetle.
Yeah.
Although John looks pretty fucking hot, I would. I don't want to get sort of caught up on the whole girl theme thing, but it is interesting that you know, it's, yeah, I think I like her, whoever she is. We've also got the, I don't like the burnt the house down at the end of it line, because I'd rather that wasn't true. Because in my mind, when I was a kid, I used to think it was just like, she's got nice pine walls, you know?
Yeah.
Because that sort of fake pine, I think we had it in our lounge.
Yeah.
A sort of fake pine panelling was quite a thing when I was growing up. So I just thought, he's just admiring her.
Isn't it good?
She's done well on the interior design.
Yeah.
I appreciate that. Maybe I'll get some for my own digs, as they used to say in the time. And obviously, lovely bit of sitar.
Absolutely, yeah.
Beautiful.
Have you heard the... There's different takes of this. I think it's take two, which sounds very much like... It's a drone, and there's a lot more sitar in it. But it sounds very much like take one of Tomorrow Never Knows.
Oh, no.
It's the same
thing.
That's interesting. The Void, I think it was called Take One of Tomorrow.
Yeah, because there's some takes that's got some extra bits they didn't use, which are awful.
Yeah.
Which I always... It's really interesting, like, seeing the sketches that get rubbed out, because you're like, yeah, you tried that and that didn't work.
Yeah.
So it was... But that's the other great thing about this record. This is an example of how good their taste was. This is really where something they did a lot, until latter. They'd find an idea, they'd use it once or twice, and then they'd move on. And how they'd use it would be in just the right amount.
Yes.
Too much sitar becomes, it dominates a track. Too little, what's the point of having it on there? It hasn't really made an impression. And this is exactly the right girth of sitar that has been inserted into this song. Has anyone used those words next to each
Absolutely.
Other?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Talking of girth, non sequitur.
Go for it.
Bob Dylan, so they say. Fourth Time Around, the song on Blonde and Blonde, which was his reaction to Norwegian Wood, which is effectively, if you hear it, it's dum 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 dum.
We all get it from somewhere.
We all do. And I think there's a line in there, I never asked for your crutch, now don't ask for mine. And I think Lennon got a bit paranoid the fact that Dylan was saying, you have really ripped me off here.
He can talk. Come on, Bob. Really,
I think. Subterranean Homesick Blues.
Yeah, I mean, it's it's very difficult for, especially, you know, white Western musicians to be going on about other people appropriating their stuff. It's
absolutely.
Like, it's music. That's how it works. Don't get precious. The face-off between the Beatles and Dylan, that's the room I would have loved to have been in, seeing the kind of the simmering jealousy and resentment and love and all these things. Yeah. That must have been quite a meeting.
It's weird, isn't it? Because there's that footage. Was it Eat the Document? I forget. There was a documentary unreleased from 66, and you've got John and Dylan in the car together.
Right. I haven't seen that.
Oh, Google it. Dylan's off his head. Dylan was in this car. He'd obviously taken a lot of something. Lennon is the worst possible person you would want to bring you down.
He'd be a terrible trip buddy, wouldn't he? He would really... He's like, what's that at the door? What? Nothing? What?
Yeah.
He would really fuck you up. With, I mean,
that's
not
what
so
he's
much
doing.
Again.
Exactly what really? He's doing, yeah.
And oh, it's... evil bastard, I love him.
But it's weird, a few years later, then George... he was the one that got best pals with Dylan. I think Lennon and Dylan and McCartney and Dylan, they could never have been. They were too much going on, wasn't there?
George is friends with everyone. Though. That's one of the things I like about George. But George is my girlfriend's favourite.
Yeah,
for many reasons. And actually, we both did parts of our degrees on Beatles stuff, and she did hers on an element of it was on the Beatles, and she. Wrote a letter to him, and not really expecting much back, but got this lovely. It's an orange envelope from the estate of George Harrison. Beautiful orange envelope with a beautiful embossed bit of sellotape, and this lovely letter saying, "Thank you very much," you know. But George can't get back. But then, just it's like a really beautiful personal bit of correspondence.
Wow.
I love that. I love the Traveling Wilburys. I love his whole. His ability to dip into different worlds and different people, and so I can see he's out of all of them. I mean, I don't want to go to the pub with all of them, but I think I'd like to go on a night out with George. Brian Cox tells a lovely story of when he was in a band in the early 80s. They played Hammersmith Apollo, and they had a particularly irascible roadie, and this roadie was queuing at the bar for a drink after the gig at the after party thing. And someone leant forward and tried to order a drink over his shoulder. And this roadie went, "Oi, fuck off!" And this voice went, "No one's told me to fuck off since 1964.
No.
And it was George. And they spent the rest of the night together.
Super.
The band, just because he was like, "You're interesting. You've got a bit of fuck off too, yeah?
Yeah.
I'll hang out with you." That's what I like about George.
Yeah, lovely.
For all his stroppiness. When I call
track 3, You Won't See Me. Sonically, piano, Paul on piano, which is one of the first times we've heard this.
That was something I should have said about Drive My Car.
Oh.
It invents house music.
Wow.
That piano. Da, 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 da.
Yeah.
That's basically, they've invented Chicago House there on that first song.
Unwittingly or knowingly.
Unwittingly or knowingly, they invented house music.
Wow.
Back to You Won't See Me. Yeah, it's... This is sort of more dissatisfaction, isn't it? This is more like it's not all great, but it's back to Ringo. It's the hi-hats, the overdub hi-hat which is great, which is his little rhythmical nuances that take the song into a completely different place.
Yeah. There's genuine drama on that time after time, and he's always there without getting in the way, but he's punctuating all of the drama in the song, and all four of them are just building up.
Yeah,
they're a proper band, aren't they?
Yeah. Well, this is it. I think there's that. You know, even on songs when they don't seem to be playing as good as they could play, their innate bond that they've got, because it's just there when they start performing together. That thing they've got carries it through. You know, it's inbuilt. I mean, it's not a song that I adore. You know, Ringo makes it happen for me. And good singing though. It's a very good singing record.
Yes,
very very close mic. The mic's very close to the voices. Mm. Yeah, we went down to Abbey Road, me and the missus, once, and got shown the microphone basement where they keep the mics.
Really?
And all held. This is the Neumann they used to sing into.
Wow.
It was pretty nuts. I get really geeky about this stuff.
Yeah. But from this point onwards, Paul started recording his bass separately.
Separately, yeah.
Which, again, for a drummer, Ringo, how was he still so good without a bass to hook onto?
He's just a great player. I mean, you know, hopefully the whole Ringo's a crap drummer thing has been well and truly dismissed now. I think people are over that, thank God. Because he's a fucking genius. Mm. He is, nobody plays like Ringo. No one else ever will play like Ringo. Mm. And every drummer, you know, owes an enormous debt to him. One, for just popularising how you can play. But the little inventive nuances. And I know Paul showed him how to do bits and pieces, but it doesn't matter. It's just his plays feel. He's just unique.
He's a real nowhere man, sitting in his nowhere land, making all his nowhere plans for nobody. Doesn't have a point of view, knows not where he's going to, isn't he?
Nowhere Man.
Yeah. Now, I never really liked this song too much because I didn't think it really went anywhere. Mm. In a kind of like, he's a bit of a nowhere man. Mm. He should get over himself. But he doesn't.
Yeah.
That's the end of the song.
Yeah.
But then you've got the harmonies.
Oh.
Then you've got some of the most amazing, close, tight, double-track harmonies that I think they ever did. It's definitely up there.
It's almost the Coles level, isn't it? The harmonies on this.
Yeah. And you've got this once again, talking about taste, the way the 12th string comes in, and they just use this immaculate little solo that ends with that beautiful little... there's a word for it, isn't there? Harmonic.
Harmonic.
It's called a harmonic, which is like... Was it a George solo?
Yes.
Good work, George.
Yeah.
Yeah, he can pull it out the bag when he needs to. It's a totally perfectly delivered solo.
It
encapsulates everything that's great about George.
Yeah.
But yeah, lyrically, I've never been that bothered. But yeah, maybe the older I get, the more I like it.
Yeah, he's...
Facts, give me more facts. I love these. These are great.
Capitol Records in America managed to effectively get 2 or 3 albums per one album
Arseholes.
In the UK.
This is an off-ranted about subject, I am sure.
Oh, yeah.
But it's a fucking disrespect to anyone. It's like going to someone's house and moving. Oh, your bedroom's in the lounge now. What? Fuck off. No, your kitchen's in the garage. But that's not... No, sorry.
Yeah.
It's sequencing a record is enormously important. There's plenty of bands who have more arguments about what order the songs go in than anything else in their entire careers. Mm. Bands spend years doing it. And they will have thought quite hard about the sequence of these songs.
Yeah.
And then Americans go and fuck it all up.
The weird thing about this one is, I mean, the 4 they took off, Drive My Car.
Oh.
If I Needed Someone.
Yeah, we'll come on to that in a minute.
What Goes On and Nowhere Man. And they replaced them with 2 songs that they hadn't issued yet, which were from Help. So It's Only Love.
Mm. Hang on. It's not I've Just Seen a Face.
And I've Just Seen a Face, yeah.
Which is a good song.
Which is a great song. But it opens with both of those, ends with the acoustic. So it's a very acoustic folk number. I'm wondering, Brian Wilson, who cites Rubber Soul as his influence at Pet Sounds.
I'm going to be an absolute wanker now and said, Brian told me that. I know, isn't that awful?
No.
I should have warned these terrible fucking name dropping I'd be doing. But
did you ask him?
Yeah, I asked him about it.
And?
It's his favourite record of theirs.
Yeah.
Very weird, isn't it, being Brian Wilson?
Yeah.
Because he's kind of not there for a bit and then he's... and he wanders off again, but he was that's the record that he loves the most.
Did he hear the US version or the UK version?
Oh, that's a good question. I don't know. I would have hoped that actually the Beatles would have got him the proper version.
I think
if you're Brian Wilson, you can make a call.
Yeah.
And get the proper one.
Yeah.
Biked over, sent over, shipped over.
Yeah.
Whatever.
Because for him, it was a concept album in the way sort of Pet Sounds was a theme concept album. And that would make more sense with a US bastardised version.
Yeah.
Possibly than it would with the UK. I don't know. Yeah.
Brian's not wrong, though. It's a good record.
I love your book, The First Time. I'm going to have to read it out. It's my favourite quote ever. And Brian, as you say, how do you communicate or do you just click, hang on to...
Yeah, it's a weird thing because it's amazing meeting Brian Wilson because he's Brian Wilson. You know, the music was all in his head. The music's still in his head to this day. And he just had to get it on the tape. And yeah, so you sort of... I've interviewed him a few times, been really fortunate to do it. And when he sits down, it's quite distant. The answers are like, yes, no, don't know. And all your beautifully wrought questions are just rendered to dust in the space of him going, no. And then after a few minutes, 10 minutes, it's like he comes into focus. I think I'll write it in the book. And he's with you, he's engaged, he's talking, he's funny, he's laughing about stories and his achievements in a kind of humble but slightly kind of I know what I did way.
Yeah.
And then it's like an eclipse. And then he fades again after about 15 minutes and he's kind of gone.
Mm.
And he often stands up to just walk out of the room.
Wow.
Thank you. What's your name? It's Matt. I'm Brian.
And he tells you who he is.
He tells you who he is and Brian goes to walk out. I'm a cork on the ocean.
I love this so much. This is from Matt Everett's book, The First Time. Every time I interviewed Brian, he seemed a little further away. It's like spotting a star in the sky that you're told is gone, but you can see how it was from millions of years in the past. The genius that shines from Brian Wilson for so long is so powerful that everyone saw it. Eventually, he started to burn himself out and collapse. So what we see now is a shadow of what he was. But the lightness reaching us from all those years ago is so brilliant, we'll see him forever. That's good.
Thanks, man.
That's good.
Yeah.
That's Brian.
Yeah, what a guy.
Yeah.
Poor Brian. Poor Brian.
Think for yourself.
Yeah.
George.
Yeah, I mean, nasty George, really.
Yeah, bitter, angry.
Bitter, angry George. It's, you know, like, it's this is the kind of flip side, isn't it? It's being quite aggressive to the, you know, the girl in the song, which is weird because this is the point, obviously, with the song, Love, as we go on. This is supposed to be when the idea of being inclusive and love everyone and you know the hippie ideal is supposed to be becoming prevalent now. Yeah. And here's one of two really pretty aggressive narky is probably a better word songs. And I kind of wonder where that comes from. I mean, George was quite a cynical guy, I guess.
I think so.
You know, but I don't really know why he was
quite consistent throughout his from the first ever song, Don't Bother Me.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, there's a consistency throughout.
He's pissed off. Really, moaning. Does he moan a bit? Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's about the fuzz bass. This is all about.
Yeah.
This is about the fuzz bass, which comes back to my thing about taste. Other bands would have taken that fuzz bass sound and made a fucking career out of it, or at the very least a whole album.
Yeah.
They use it once. I don't think they ever use it again on another track ever.
Me, Mr. Mustard. I
has
think.
Got fuzz in the background?
I think it has. Boom boom.
boom, boom.
Maybe,
boom,
yeah, boom. Maybe it is. You're right.
But
that
I get
shows
your point. Yeah.
Exceptional taste. Yeah. It's not just what you've got. It's how you use it and just knowing when to just put a little bit of something in. So I love it for that. It's a really, really good bass line. It's all over the shop, isn't it? It goes down the shops, back again, bag of chips, gets back again. It's everywhere all over it, which saves, you know, which saves the sort of slightly dubious lyrical content. Yeah. But, you know, but just because you're a Beatle doesn't mean you can't moan about stuff.
I think, yeah. I mean, for Beatles fans, their perfection, we're allowed to claw away at the...
Exactly. You know, this is
family. They're the kids.
Exactly.
You've been naughty. Get to your room. It's that. But nothing more.
Yeah. Yeah. Bless them. Bless them all.
The word.
This is what we were just talking about, wasn't it? So yeah, this is. It's a funny song, this, because it is. It's all about the, hey man, dude, hey man, love each other. And I think, what's the line? I'm here to show everyone the light. It's like, oh, John, come on! Literally, you were.
Yeah.
You've literally had your first bifter about 12 months ago.
Yeah.
And now you are the all-seeing oracle of brotherly love. Yeah. I mean, really?
Yeah.
I find it a little bit rich.
Again, look at the front cover. Look at his face on the front cover.
Yeah.
Who else on that album is going to use that lyric?
Yeah. It's the God complex, isn't it, a little bit?
Yeah.
But I quite like it as a tune.
Oh,
quite like it as a tune. You've got some good drumming on there again. You've got some great tambourines. The Shakers. It's not just drumming. It's the Shakers on this tune. Back to my theory, two of the 18 theories I've got about this. It's the first great percussive record of theirs. Very, very good. Great tambourine playing and great shaker playing can change a record.
Yeah.
And it does it on this because it propels the whole thing along. It's funny, have you heard the word is love? You only heard it.
Have you heard?
Yeah, exactly. I guess, I don't know, for them, I think that Paul was there talked at the time about story songs, about how, like, oh, we've come across this thing now, like, we think songs should be stories. I think if you saw this sort of hippie scene emerging, whereas, you know, lots of people, this is it, this is the future, and it turned out to be a element of cultural future. But there's no reason why necessarily they'd be looking at it and thinking, like, that's the one next big thing. Maybe music hall's the next big thing. Maybe, you know, a music concrete or avant-garde is the next thing. I think just the fact there's only one song like this on here shows they were absorbing it, but not necessarily, you know, I don't think they're fully signed up to the hippie ideals just quite yet.
No.
As you can tell from other songs on the record.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah. The perception of love is quite ambiguous in some of the...
Yeah. One of your favourites or not? You feel a little bit...
What, with this song? I love this song. It's one of my favourite... Climactic ending of the... It just builds and builds and builds, and you've got the final bit where they're going, and the world. And you think, hang on, how did I get here? This song that was sort of plodding along, and you think, I'm in Nirvana at the moment with this this amazing three-part harmony, double-tracked falsettos, and...
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I love
it. Very good at writing endings.
Yeah.
This is something, as, you know, I'm not... A fantastic musician by any stretch of the imagination, but I know a few. And the art of writing a good ending, they're very good at intros. People don't give them credit for the actual endings of songs. That's a good ending.
Yeah.
You know, fade out, very rarely.
Yeah.
You know, you can, if you write a good finish, I reckon.
And we end side one with Michelle.
Shagging. I mean, basically, it's a shagging song, isn't it?
It is. I think Paul has basically you can picture him as a kid, because this was back in the cavern, wasn't it? He was doing this sort of thing. He'd be messing around, sort of showing, yeah, hey, look at this.
Yeah.
And
fluttering those eyelashes at the, yeah, front row.
And I reckon every time he played that, he was happy.
Well, I mean, once again, look at him. He's fucking gorgeous, isn't he?
He is.
I mean, they all are. But, yeah, this is... It's... I didn't get that when I started listening to it when I was a little kid. But then you do kind of... You look at the wider context. Mm. I mean, not that... I mean, you know, I'm sure the Beatles had enough popularity with the ladies without distinct to them in French, which makes it a little bit puerile.
Yeah.
But you're right, it's Paul and his exercise book at school, isn't it?
Mm. You know? I think it's also the fact that they were rushing to get this album out for Christmas.
Yeah.
And they were clawing for, oh, what was that one you used to do in the cabinet? Oh, we do that one. And they probably, yep, that's an idea. And again, it's a rushed album. I just find it, so this is just an old track. Yeah, we'll redo that one. Yeah. Like one after 909 on Let It Be.
Yeah.
This is just possibly that.
On stick it on. Song. And we'll put a bouzouki on it. Is that how you pronounce it? Whatever that Greek instrument is? The...
Oh, that's girl. That's girl.
Right. Oh, sorry. No, I'm getting... Sorry, I'm getting mistaken. Carry on.
On, yeah. Michelle, yeah.
I'm sorry. I'm, yeah, leaping forward, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's... That's...
But it's, again, those backing harmonies.
Yeah, there we go. Once again, beautiful, tight, gorgeous, lovely, close mic harmonies that make it kind of special.
Yeah.
So yeah, we'll tolerate Paul's teen lust writ large in French. Yeah.
There's a little joke on there as well. I want you, I want you, I want you. I think you know by now, which is kind of a piss take. But they've got that humour. They've got that humour here. But a few years later, John was doing exactly the thing. I want you. She's so heavy.
Yeah.
Repeating that, but there was no irony. There was no. I think you know by now. He was deadly serious saying, I want you. I want you so bad. It's the same thing.
It's the same thing, just in French. On You Won't See Me, there's the line, I wouldn't mind if I knew what I was missing.
Mm.
Which is, like, more thwarted, isn't it? It's, yeah, just like, oh, God, come on.
Yeah.
I'm Paul McCartney.
Yeah.
Let's have a go. Yeah. It's shocking. That just popped into my head. It's a lusty record, this. The more I talk about it.
It is.
You know.
And yeah, it's weird. You've got the they are stronger women characters, but they're still mainly getting treated like crap.
Yeah, but I think this is also a record, I think, where Theory Number 29, where they knew they could only write so much about, you know, I wanna hold your hand. They'd progressed a long way since there. But this is, yeah, this is really more how they feel about things at any one given time than they've ever written about in one chunk before. What goes on?
Flipping over to side two, we've got Ringo. You interviewed Ringo, haven't you?
Yeah.
Tell me about that.
I've interviewed Ringo twice. Once again, he's really cool.
Yeah.
Once was he was doing a rehearsal for his all-star band, who were brilliant, by the way. Have you seen them?
I haven't.
Go.
Which lineup did
Go.
You have?
It was about 3 years ago. So okay. There was a dude from Toto, a dude from Mister. Greg Bissonette on drums, who's amazing.
Yeah.
Todd Rundgren was in the band as well.
Was he?
Which was insane.
Wow.
I went to go sing with my mum in New York and my brother. And it's like the best wedding band ever. And then Ringo comes and sings songs.
Yeah.
It's the best thing.
Yeah.
So he was doing rehearsals and we did a first time show with him. And it was just me and him in a sort of weird sort of industrial office block thing next to this rehearsal studio. And it wasn't one of the first big interviews I did, but it was certainly a biggie. And at one point I start really fluffing the questions listening back to the tape. I just start losing it because this is a while ago. He said, so okay, just ask me what you want and I'll answer it. And he like took control and just steady on,
yeah,
the voice.
How cool is that?
Just slow down, it's gonna be all right. And after the interview, I was chatting to his drum tech, and I was like, can I have a pair of drumsticks? And Ringo came up, and saw we were chatting, he went, no, I don't do that, because people take them, and they put them on eBay, and they flog them, and I fucking hate it. So I do it. I auction off my own drumsticks every so often for charity. Ah. So no. And I said, but I said, I am a drummer. He went, and I said, that your kit over there? And I pointed at his kit and said, that's a 16 by 16 floor tom, a 13 by 7 rec tom, a 22 by 14 bass drum, and a 14 by 6.5 snare drum. And that's the 22-inch crash and the 20 crash.
Yeah.
And he nodded and he's...
No
and
way!
He's, and he's tech gummy pair of sticks. Isn't that lovely? And then the time after that, I interviewed him, it was my birthday. Yeah. And his lovely, lovely PR people knew. And when I turned up, he gave me a birthday card that he'd written.
Whoa.
So all this, like, don't fucking sign autographs.
Yeah.
I think that's bollocks. And he's so charming, and he's funny as fuck. Mm. He's fucking hilarious.
Yeah.
He's just as funny as you want. He looks good as well. Ringo's looking great.
He looks amazing.
Ringo's looking awesome these days.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He just hasn't aged since 1972.
Laughs a lot in interviews, which is always a sign, I think, of a pretty cool person.
Yeah.
If they're kind of, even after all this time,
yeah,
they're still laughing. But yeah. this is one of my favourite Ringo vocals.
Really? Okay.
Because I think he's quite committed to it.
Yeah.
You're nodding. As he loves.
No, I was thinking, but this is it's not one of my favourite songs, but I love hearing Ringo enjoying himself. And
yeah.
Obviously, country music. You've done Honey Don't and mm-hmm. Act Naturally. There's a theme that will continue. Buku's Blues is one of my favourite solo Beatle albums.
Yeah, exactly.
I love it.
Yeah,
and he's loving it. He's really enjoying it.
This is the one that I mentioned in reference. I think it was recorded quite late, this, if I'm not mistaken, quite late in the day. And this is the one where, if it's George and John on guitar, I'm not sure. It's definitely... The guitar playing is a right old fucking mess.
It's weird, isn't it?
All over the shop. It's like they play a little bit and then they stop playing and then they strum a bit and it's like, what the fuck is going on? But because of their innate understanding of the way that each other play, unconscious understanding... It sounds really good.
Yeah.
If you just think, oh, I'll just listen to that bit of guitar. It's terrible.
Yeah.
It's really, really bad.
Yeah.
It's like the solo on All You Need Is Love when you're like, have you just forgotten to...
Did you just stop playing?
Did you just... Was that... This is... Wow.
Yeah.
Fucking hell, mate.
Yeah.
This is... Did, no.
Plowing along and then...
Yeah, I'm done now. All right. But because, as this I say, because even when they weren't playing their best, and this is not them playing their best, they're still better than most people will ever play ever.
Absolutely,
so I love it for that reason. It shouldn't work, this song, but it does.
Is there anybody going to listen to my story all about the girl who came to stay? She's the kind of girl you want so much it makes you sorry. Still, you don't regret a single day. Oh, girl. Girl.
Side two, track two, Girl.
Another one of these women.
Yeah.
I think. I've got to be careful not just to stick on this theme, because this is not the theme of the record. But it is very interesting that, you know, she's the kind of girl that puts you down when friends are there. You feel a fool. You know, this is another. They're not in control of the situation. Maybe that's it. Maybe it's not just about women. Maybe it's like being out of control of everything. I don't know.
Again, it sounds like it's Mother to me.
You reckon?
Yeah.
Oh, John.
But and possibly Yoko. Don't know. It's just that very strong, forceful, independent kind of femme fatale. Don't know.
Yeah,
hopefully,
yeah.
Hopefully I'm wrong.
And then tit, 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 tit. Then you've got, like, a beautifully puerile boob gag slipped in there. I remember this one used to give me the willies when I was younger, because it's a really odd-sounding song. You've got this. Bouzouki, is that how you say it?
Well, it's actually an acoustic with the capo really up high, but, you know, mimicking a bouzouki.
Kind of weird Greek thing, which is that weird, lovely thing if you grow up with the Beatles, is that the first time you hear lots of these musical sounds is on their records, and then you grow up to realise, oh, they didn't invent this.
Yeah,
this comes from Greek folk music. Yeah. It's a bit... It always used to give me... It used to feel a little bit, will she still believe it when he's dead?
Yeah, quite dark.
That's really dark, you know? A man must break his back to earn his day of leisure. It's...
Yeah, lyrically, that... Even from Help a few months ago, his lyrics are just
he was so more creative. I'm guessing possibly due to the lysergic influence, but I think also because he'd had his second book published as well, I think he was gaining confidence that people did actually want to hear him, his real lyrics rather than
which is DJ. You know, I'm all about expression, but yeah, surely this is not peace and love.
No,
this is not peace and love. This is pretty horrible. Give her a break, yeah. Man, you know. So yeah, it feels. But that's one of the good things about the record. It kind of it missteps you quite a lot.
Absolutely, yeah.
This it's the songs, although they all feel the same in many ways, kind of stylistically take you on a bit of a different kind of journey than they've done before, I think.
Mm. Well, John actually said this, girl, there is no such thing as the girl. This girl was a dream, but the words were right. It wasn't just a song, and it was about that girl that turned out to be Yoko. So he's effectively predicting Yoko.
He wrote a song about the future.
He did.
He wrote a song about someone he met in the future. Of course he did.
He did. The one thing that I always pick up on this is during the bouzouki section, yeah. It always reminds me of the cheese shop sketch. And I keep expecting John Cleese to shut that bloody bouzouki up.
Yes, it is. But that's... Yeah, I mean, this is why George Martin, and we should never forget to talk about how brilliant he is, would have... This would have worked, boys. Don't worry. It'll sound good. And yeah. You can sort of feel him. You can feel his steady hand on the tiller, making sure that although the sound was a bit weird, that the arrangement and the placement in the song was so perfect.
Yeah. You know?
And luckily, as we say, they have great taste. They didn't go on to do a bouzouki record. Were there other bands that suddenly got the bouzouki craze off the back of this?
Yeah, they all copied the sitar.
Exactly.
But the bouzouki never.
This is it. In a parallel universe, there was a whole fucking the Rolling Stones did. Well, actually, we're always into bouzouki. Yeah. It didn't work. We happened to be. They just got it on record first. Yeah, right. Yeah, Mick.
Biggest bouzouki.
Yeah, Satanic Manages was our own idea. We had it at the same time. Yeah, you didn't. I mean, it's Sergeant Pepper. Fucking hell.
Yeah, painted bouzouki.
Yeah, I want to hear. The history of popular music.
Yeah.
If that was the sound that got picked up.
Yeah. Like everyone went to India, should have gone to Greece.
Everybody went to Greece. And that's when I released the record. It was just me and Yoko smashing plates.
Two virgins cover surrounded by brook.
Dush. 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 Oh my god, that's good. I'm looking through you. Where did you go? I thought I knew you. What did I know? You don't look different, but you have changed. I'm looking through you. You're not the same. What's next?
Track 3. I'm looking through you. Things not going so well with Jane and Paul lyrically.
Yeah, is
but
that what
musically,
it is?
Beautiful piece of music.
Yeah, I've always liked the music on this. I mean, this is the point, like, because it's so familiar and you grow up with it, you sort of have to stop and take the engine apart when you're doing something like this.
Yeah.
And we were doing it last night. We were listening to the record, listening to the original vinyl, which sounds really crackly and old and great.
Mm.
I mean, I love all the remasters. They're brilliant, and Giles has done an amazing job. But I like listening to it as my mum would listen to it. And it sounds beautiful, this record. But I never really dug into the lyrics too much on this one. And you're right, yeah, Paul's having a hard time, isn't he? You know?
He is. I think, I mean, it's, yeah, basically Jane was having a career. And
what, and he was jealous? Oh, you are fucking kidding. Come on, mate. Really? You're in the fucking Beatles. Seriously.
Yeah, yeah. Apparently there was a lot of arguments about that.
What, that she went out to go and be like an actress and then make cakes and shit?
Yeah.
Fucking hell, man.
Nice cakes, though.
Very good kid, good actress.
A good actress.
Lot of time,
actress.
Jane Asher. She's brilliant, but yeah. Oh, my God.
It was the 60s. It's weird, isn't it? The prism now, it's... Hard to justify lyrically a lot of Beatles material these days.
Yeah.
So I say, listen to the music.
Listen to the music. This is one that hasn't. It's got the Isn't Ringo playing the legs in the background?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, which is quite a nice thing. They did that a couple of times.
They did. They did all sorts of suitcases.
Yeah,
all
yeah,
sorts,
yeah. John Bonham did a. It's is it Ramble On? A lot of John Bonham thigh on that thighs.
I like.
Is it, even Ringo's thighs sounded good.
Yeah,
presumably they were his thighs. Unless he rented in. Did he get someone else and play their thighs, or did someone else? Paul's thighs on that one. Yeah. Oh, they weren't as good. You didn't know it wasn't Paul's thighs.
On the stereo mix, you can hear Ringo.
You can hear
John on the left.
We remastered the denim of the trousers to make the thighs sound like they originally did at Abbey Road. Yeah. It's a beautiful song, though.
It is.
It's a lovely song. Yeah. Here we go. Come on. Next is a biggie, isn't it?
There are places I remember.
In My Life.
Yeah.
Where do you begin with this?
It's a masterpiece, isn't it?
Mm.
I mean, I do have to say, it's Ringo again. I mean, the lyrics are exemplary, and it's why we love Lennon, isn't it? Because we know what he's capable of.
Yeah.
From the darker side. But these are just perfect. How old was he at the time?
24, 25.
Fucking hell. Jesus, it's like when you find out that Pete Townsend was like in his late 20s when he wrote Quadrophenia. It's like you're writing a concept album about something that happened to you about 9 years ago.
Yeah,
it's insane.
Yeah.
It's beautiful. It's so evocative of not just him. It's evocative. It's the great universal song, isn't it? It's about absolutely when you hear it, it's you. It's about you. It's about the person listening to it. It's Lennon offering up his own life for you to think about yours.
Yes.
And Ringo is incredible. It's impossible to think about this song without that. So sparse, beautiful little... And it's great. It's the feel of it, the way and where the beats are placed. Are they as important to the track as the lyrics? I don't know. It wouldn't be the same without those drums. It's perfect. Other bands wouldn't even put a fucking drummer on there.
No.
Whereas Ringo just comes in and does exactly what he needs to do. It's heartbreakingly, in my life, I love you more. Yeah. It's here are all these beautiful things that happened to me. Here's these amazing things that changed my life. And they're all brilliant. And they made me who I am, but that's nothing compared to you.
Yeah.
Oh my God, I'm going to cry.
Oh, I know I'll never lose affection.
It's that feeling of this is the person I'm supposed to be with. This is the person I love more than anybody else. Everywhere I've been through my life up until this point has made me who I am, but I'm really here for you.
Yeah.
You know?
It's one of the few songs John wrote about himself that anybody can relate to.
Yeah.
I think that's possibly one of my favourite songs.
And it is, yeah. It's heartbreakingly sad, you know.
Mm.
Places I remember, some have changed, some forever, not for better, which is a great line.
Mm.
Oh, the way he sings that. But it's this beautiful melancholy that's resolved at the end of every verse. It's a masterpiece. It's an absolute masterpiece.
Yeah. And I think also, as Beatles fans as well, when he's saying people who I've lost, and you know he's talking about his mum, Stuart Sutcliffe.
Yeah, of course.
It adds another element as well, but...
Yeah.
What a song.
God, they were good.
They were pretty good, weren't they?
It's been a long time. Now I'm coming back home. I've been away now. Oh, how I've been alone. Wait till I come back to your side. We forget the tears we cry.
We can move on to Wait.
Yeah.
Which was a leftover from Help. And they dubbed over a few few more bits of percussion.
Percussion, great percussion. This is it. It's the percussion record. This is, if that's the most poignant thing I come out of, is that I show off about interviewing people and I love percussion.
Yeah.
That's my legacy. Yeah, it's got that driving thing. It barrels along again, you know.
Mm.
And Ringo's playing. There's the build-up in the second half and he comes in with this sort of rollicking, falling down the stairs, thing that he does.
Yeah.
And it's just great. No one else does that. No one else does that.
Yeah. What do you think? Because I was listening to this and obviously Help was only a few months before Rubber Soul, but it was a lifetime ago in Beatle years. Mm-hmm. And you can hear how much his drumming has progressed because on the drumming on this during the chorus, he's using a lot of cymbal, which he did mainly during the live gigs, just to be heard.
Smacking the crap out of them, yeah.
Yeah, and on the other tracks, he's holding back a bit. And I know that when The Who were doing Who's Next, Glyn Johns was saying to Keith Moon, pull away from you don't need the cymbals all the time. And it's a different, you sort of hear 70s Keith.
Yeah, you're right.
Who's Next? Same thing here. I'm wondering if George might have...
I think that...
Martin.
Maybe, I don't know. Maybe he could just hear himself better in the studio. Maybe this was it. Maybe he was just a bit knackered. Yeah. And so he was playing a bit less. Yeah. Obviously, this is Ringo's kind of coming-of-age album, you know. And just the sound of the drums is so beautifully recorded.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're heading into Rain territory, aren't we? We're heading into She Said territory now.
Yeah.
So his confidence is building. Maybe that's it. Maybe he could just fucking hear himself play now.
Yeah.
Or he wasn't touring. Maybe he was, you know, maybe he was starting to have more time just to listen to himself.
Mm.
You know? Yeah.
And the songs themselves were...
Yeah. Maybe that's it.
Had more space.
Love it, man. Love it, man.
If I needed someone to... If I needed someone, if I had some more time to spend, then I guess I'd be with you, my friend. If I needed someone.
If I needed someone, the penultimate track, and here's George again. Double-edged sword with this one.
Oh, really?
Musically, amazing. Lyrically, bit harsh, perhaps.
Right, now, I will take umbrage with that. This is probably, with the exception of It In My Life, this is the one for me on this record.
Mm.
The playing is great, clearly. I think the imagery is just fantastic. Carve your number on my wall. That's a good line.
Maybe I'll give you a call.
Exactly, yeah. You could say, well, you know, it's musically, it kind of sits in one place. Mm. You know, and sort of finds that spot. But it's a very good spot to sit.
Yeah.
Especially if you're really stoned. It's just a good place to be, just sitting in this. The 12-string playing is just immaculately beautiful, once again. I think, was it a bit of a... The Birdsian thing was obviously coming in
time.
A fair bit.
Yeah.
But yeah,
which they'd effectively pinched from the Beatles, so...
You can do that. And, you know, if had you come some other day, then it might not have been like this. You know, it's all, it's hesitance, and it's not wanting to give all of yourself away just yet.
Mm.
You know, if I needed someone, not I need someone, if I needed someone, it would be you.
Yeah.
But it's you, clearly.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's weird. I don't know why, because I know that they've done songs that are better regarded, but there's something about this record, that particular track, that just really, really hits me in the heart.
The solo as well, when they're doing the harmonies, this real trebly guitar solo.
Exactly, yeah. We can just sit on that place. We don't, songs don't always have to go anywhere.
Yeah.
You know, songs can just find their location and just stay there.
Yeah.
It's a great place. It's a lovely place.
Well, I'd rather see you dead, little girl, than to be with another man. You better. For your life if you can, little girl.
Okay, and we move on to the very last track. A delicious little song about misogyny and death threats.
I mean, what a terrible way to finish a great record.
It's weird, isn't it?
I mean, because I like Lennon singing on it. It's full of that vituperative, the way he sings is brilliant.
Yeah.
But it's a fucking nasty song, isn't it? It's like, this is the man that was just singing love, you know, it's the word love, it's brilliant, and I'd rather see you dead than with somebody else. And the way I'm singing it, you believe it.
Yeah.
What was this about?
It was the first song to be recorded, it's the first one that went to the studio. Yeah.
God.
This and Norwegian Wood. Norwegian Wood didn't work out. They re-recorded it. But this was the first song they recorded for the album.
My God.
So whether they didn't have... They said they were desperately in need of songs, but surely they would have had another one. But musically and melodically, it's fun.
It's strange that when albums finish on like a slightly... It's not just the lyrical content. It feels a little bit insubstantial. It's still better than most bands. Yeah. Most bands would kill for a melodic turn of phrase like that.
Yeah, you know? But it's sort of like it's not an album closer. Yeah. Whatever the lyrics aside, it's a sort of B side.
Does it fade out as well at the end? Oh. I think maybe it does.
Yeah. No.
Yeah, that's a cop out.
Yeah.
Yeah, could try harder, but you don't care after the rest of the record, though, do you?
Yeah,
it is. It's an incredible piece of work, because it is. It's, you know, it's not just a marijuana record. I think that's because of that you get the like the whole sound where, you know, they'd play these songs faster if they weren't a bit stoned, but it makes it slightly more, you know, it's heavier. It's the start of them getting heavy.
Mm.
You know, Ticket to Ride, heavy song.
Yeah,
heavy song. And this is where we are now with them, you know. This is a heavy band, and I think that, you know, they're aware of what else is going on around them, Dylan and whoever, to really up their game. They can't do the same record again twice, which they nearly did before.
Yes,
very close. This is not the same record. Nothing would ever be the same again after this.
Yeah.
I mean, the logo. I mean, the font alone basically invented like. Sort of counterculture and 60s graphic design in one go, didn't it? Really, that's it.
Yeah.
That's the thing.
Oh.
You know, it invents a lot.
Oh, hang on. I've got to remember, you know, designed that is...
I knew. I did an
essay. The father of Rebecca Front.
Really? Wow.
Yeah.
I love all those connections to, like... Yeah, it's... That's it, because they're so... They're so famous, they're so pervasive. I was listening to the Quantic show when he was talking about Ricky Gervais's, the girl that Ricky Gervais liked, played.
Oh, yeah.
Did
Shona.
Did some string arrangements on a Beatles track. And, my dear close friends, Roddy and Ali, Ali's mum and dad, were Cavern regulars.
Oh,
so
wow.
You go around the house and you know, her mum, Bernie, used to date George. So you go around and there's like little photos of them.
Oh, wow.
And I interviewed, one of the times I interviewed Paul McCartney, it was her birthday, it was Bernie's birthday. Awesome woman. And I did that thing that you're not supposed to do in an interview. I said, oh, it's one of my friend's birthdays. And you could hear Paul, because he must get asked this stuff all the time.
Yeah.
And I said, oh, it's you probably won't remember, it was... a friend of yours and the band's from the county is Bernie. And he was like, oh, I remember Bernie.
Really?
And his voice lit up and he sung Happy Birthday to her, which we then played out at Bernie's birthday. And it was a beautiful moment because he remembered her.
Yeah.
And it wasn't just, oh, can you say hello to, you know, my daughter, although I did do that with him.
Half an hour later.
That was a different interview, but I did get him to do it. And it was beautiful. So there's, I love the fact they're so pervasive that, you know, there are different people. There are little links to everyone.
Yeah.
People that you know that connect you directly with them, which I think is a beautiful thing. So I love the fact that, you know, that we know the name of, we know someone on Twitter or whatever whose father designed that logo. It's brilliant.
Yeah. Yeah. It's all another link in the chain.
Yeah. It's, it's funny because, as I say, I've been sort of taking the record apart and sort of looking at this, I know, the engine of all the different bits and the lyrics here and the playing there. And even though now you think, oh, that bit wasn't played brilliantly, or like, oh, that was rushed, or that lyric's a bit shit. Now it's even easier to stand back and look at the whole thing without thinking about any of that and just go, it's just brilliant. It's just an absolutely marvellous record. And they may have done better albums. I know Revolver's supposed to be the cool one, you know, and Abbey Road's, quote-unquote, the masterpiece. But it's not about that. It's about what the records mean to you. You or me or you or whoever. And for me, that's the record that I used to pull out of my mum's record cupboard. The one out of all of them that I was fascinated by more than any other because of hearing their songs on the compilation of The Red and Blue. And it's the one that I still have in my record collection now that she let me have, that's moved with me all around the country. Every time I move house, I always take this. It's been like I've lost everything else over the years. Trousers, jeans, you know, friends, Lord knows what. But I've never lost this.
Wow.
And I'm going to give it to, you know, it's going to stay in the family. And it's the record that made me fall in love with them as people who weren't just the hits. And I felt a character from this record I didn't feel from the compilation records from Red and Blue. And it makes me think that, you know, suede, brown suede's cool. Long hair's cool. That graphic design, you know, I was a graphic designer for a little bit. And that's all, you know, even the Saul Bass-esque back cover.
Yeah.
You know, this is why I spent years when I was a teenager carrying drum kits on buses in Birmingham to rehearsal studios and playing terrible gigs to no one for years and years and years. And this is why I moved to London to join a band, was because of this record. And this is why when that band went tits up, I joined another band who did wear, you know, suede jackets. And after that, I wanted to speak to musicians and interview musicians and talk about music, because I think it's really important. And this is why. Rubber Soul, that's why I'm here talking to you right now. That's why I wanted to talk about it.
Matt Everett, thank you so much for your time. I would definitely recommend anybody listening out there, check out Matt's book, The First Time. Matt, thank you so much. It's been brilliant.
It's been amazing. Thank you so much. And yeah, it's been a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thank you.